We're back to the Neil Haley Show and also the Media Giant Effect. I'm excited to welcome first my co-host, Dr. Ted Groundler. Dr. Ted, how are you? And I continue to have these fun conversations. You never know, but he is Mr. Researcher in the kind of questions he asks, right, Dr. Ted?
Well, I mean, I'm not a movie expert, so I have to do a little bit of homework in order to ask some halfway intelligent questions.
Oh, see, so. I just have conversations with people and I find out from them and I ask the best follow-up questions in the world. That's where my skill set is in over 9,000 plus interviews. I can ask any follow-up question. And it's so funny, a funny quick story, and then we're going to let our guest on. Basically, I was doing an education talk show my first year, 13 years in the business as of December 6th, but I would always say, why can't you come up with follow-up questions for education, whoever we're interviewing? They said, it's so hard. I said, this is the easiest thing in the world. I should have known. It's just, I can ask any follow-up question. But my guest today is Jennifer Sklias-Gahan, actress, and much, much more. Jennifer, thanks for stopping by. And how did you first become an actor? How did that process begin for you?
Oh, that's an interesting story. I actually fell into it accidentally. I was 22. I was a new mother, trying to get out of college and finish my degree. And I was working a few jobs. And at that time, this is 1993, you know, we looked in the paper, help wanted, and I would just get an odd job on the weekend. And one of them was assisting for a producer who did rap videos. And he had me on, I did a series of videos with him, assisting him. And during one of them, one of the actresses was giving them trouble and they fired her and they said, you fit the costume, you can do it. And he put me in the video. That's where it started. And then I thought, wow, I like this. I have a background in dance when I was younger. I was in a dance company and my mother's an immigrant from Greece. And so when I started leaning into being professional, she put a stop to that because, as she told me, that's not why I came to this country, for you to be an artist. If you want to be an artist, you can go back to Greece.
Oh, man.
Doctor, lawyer, engineer. So it was frowned upon, the arts. Not that they didn't appreciate the arts, but they didn't want me working in the arts. So when I fell into it later on, it hooked. And, you know, I resisted it for a little while and then I went in. And that's sort of how it happened. Jobs showed up kind of naturally. Yeah.
Well, speaking of arts, I mean, it sounds as if you are nothing but arts, writing, acting. You're a musician, a pianist, producer. I mean, it's all arts. And so it seemed like you took like a 180 degree turn from the sciences. And that's you. That's where your skill set is. So that's you got to do what you got to do. That satisfies you. What was your major in college?
I said to my mom, you know, what about if I major in literature? And because I always wrote as a child and I read a lot. I sort of escaped through reading. And she wanted me to have a skill and she wanted me to be a lawyer. So in order for me to have her help me pay for college, she said, you have to study political science. So I was a political science major. I was a double major, journalism and political science. I figured, okay, writing, what's close to that with a skill, journalism, which is not, it's very different. I did work as a journalist for a few years and I worked on Capitol Hill. It's funny because when I was majoring in political science, they ask you to concentrate on, you know, you have to have a specific concentration. And I picked Soviet foreign policy. While I was in school, the Berlin Wall came down. My history teacher said the day after, well, you all overnight became history students because the Soviet Union had fallen. So I left. I was a journalist for a few years and really slowly but surely angled into the arts. But it took me a while because I had because it wasn't what was expected of me.
No.
So, you know, but I'm glad I found it. It haunts you until you do it. It doesn't leave you
alone. Exactly. And think about poli sci, the political science, because I did do a lot of poli sci courses when I was undecided at Western Maryland before I transferred to LaRoche College for history for my undergrad and got my master's degree at Duquesne. I really found it fascinating studying political science. I don't know. I don't know why I wasn't really in my freshman year. I was playing basketball and didn't really be folk, but it was such intriguing stuff, isn't it? So studying
the way the world works.
Yeah. And just how it works and what understanding those things and really diving deeper into things, it's very, very interesting in my opinion. And it's something that we need to know, our political system, how it works, what happens and why it happens, and specifically why our government works the way it works. And so I enjoyed that. And I enjoy teaching government when I was teaching history. So let's kind of jump into specifically enough. What do you think your greatest moments so far in acting would have been?
I think, well, I wrote a script that was a short that actually was pulled out of a feature length script that is in development, and the house in the middle of the street did emerge out of that. That world is still operating. But I wrote a piece about a woman, and at the beginning of the film, and I played her. Her name was Matilda, and the film is called Matilda. You don't really know. I won't spoil it, but you know, we enter into her world, and it's a very isolated world. And that part was very was a challenging role to play, because she faced all her fears in her apartment in that one night, and came to a resolution and made a decision by the end. But, you know, I think it's really exciting as an actor to be able to really look at what it is to be human, and the thoughts that we think, and the actions that we take, and the consequences that we have to face. And as an actor, to really go there, you always have to look at yourself too. So, you know, I feel like that was probably the most interesting role that I've ever done. And I felt like it changed me as a person, really, to go through that.
That was very dramatic. Yeah, definitely. Can we speak of short films? Because other than going to film festivals, I don't have any exposure to short films. And I'm curious as to if they are much more difficult to do than a feature length, because you have less time to get what you need, the point of your short film across.
I think that format is very difficult, because you have a very limited amount of time to develop a story and to get people to care about what's going on in the character. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, whoever's involved in the making of it, you know, everyone has to love what they're doing, because it's grueling. The hour you have to work very long hours, the post-production is hard. You know, it takes a lot of heart, and you have to want to do it, you know, to get enough done. The editing is pretty difficult, because again, you'll film much more likely than you need, but you have to give up certain scenes and performances that are beautiful and that are interesting in order to really keep that arc concise, so that people understand there's a beginning, middle, and end. It's, you know, the punch is the best thing. And I think for short films, most are proof of concept for something, a larger world, you know, that the story's coming out of.
Well, it sounds a lot like when you're trying to write, it seems like being succinct is much more difficult to do, but yet much more effective. And so it sounds like it's the same with a short film as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, cool. This latest project, The House in the Middle of the Street, it's very, very interesting. I was intrigued by it, because it brings some of your Greek heritage into this, and then also how it's talking about children and stuff. So tell us about that project.
Right. That story came out of this larger world, this feature that is in development, because I used some of the characters from that world in this one. But I was writing a few short scripts. One of them was filmed in a day. We filmed it. We kept it really short. It's coming out next week, actually, called Tonight Is Your Night. And I wrote a second one that I've never directed. I will direct it in February. So my agent at the time had read those two tiny scripts, and she said, you know, she encouraged me to keep writing. And I had a few storylines. I had about three storylines running, very different. One of them took place in this house, the house in the middle of the street. It's hard to explain how it happened, but I was waking up at like 5:30 in the morning last year, beginning of October, and I was playing with two storylines, and this one really pulled me, and it sort of wrote itself. Like, some of the characters that I know from my larger script showed up, the character of Minerva, who owned the house and passed away and then bequeathed it to her next of kin. And I got up every morning, I sat down, and I just started to write, and this came out. I mean, I really don't know where it came from, the boy and the girl visiting, but, you know, if you saw some of it or you read a little bit of it, they really represent, I think it's a very simple story about, again, facing your demons and having boundaries and seeing signs in your life that are telling you maybe this is dangerous, but you overlook it, or mm-hmm. other people overlook it in your life, and you try to get them to see what's happening, but they won't. And ultimately you have to decide what you let into your life and who you let into your life and who you don't. And the children really, you know, they represent the demons that pull you away from who you really are. Mm. And I believe in my life experience that, you know, the world is filled with everything. But none of us are really victims as adults. Maybe children can be innocent victims, but when you're an adult, if you have any kind of awareness, it really is your choice whether you let something into your space or not. And that's really, that's what the children are, and the choices that the family members make, and they all make different choices on how they want to live, you know? And, you know, in a very simple sense, it's about boundaries. I just placed it in a world that is mystical and, you know, with mythological creatures. And I do think, like, you know, as someone with Greek heritage, my family always like read me stories, and I was immersed in all the fairy tales from all the different cultures, and I really enjoyed storytelling. My uncle would always tell stories orally, and you know, I believe that that's how we've always learned how to live. You know, those old stories are not just entertainment; they help people with extreme conditions understand what the world is and how we live. It interests me. I love that, you know, and
Were your family stories as detailed as this?
My uncle was a storyteller. I would say yes.
Really? Wow. Mm-hmm. That's a gift.
Yeah.
I was going into so much of the detail. I was trying to figure out if there was some meaning to like number 17 for the house.
Yeah, there is a meaning for it. It's a number of a house that I lived at.
Okay. And
many of the symbols in the story come from my life even though, you know, did creatures show up at my door, you know, and pull my father away? No. But the glass jars, for instance, when I was a child, for whatever reason, my family, they were hardworking immigrants, and they didn't really celebrate. We didn't really celebrate Christmas growing up. New Year's was really the holiday to celebrate. And, you know, in Greece at that time, like Little Christmas is more European. You would exchange gifts at New Year's Eve. So that was really the celebration, and everybody was very joyful. And I got very serious right before midnight, and I would take a glass jar and run around and catch the air in the jar. And then I would put the year on it. And oh, wow. I, some reason I believed that maybe it was a story I read and I don't recall, but I believed that catching that would catch anything that was not meant to go into the future. And it would help us start a new year in a great way. So, I mean, and then one day I stopped doing that. It was just a childhood ritual. But it, while I was writing, it came up in my mind. So I just mixed it in. So I think there's always like, you know, you use your own life. And, and I've definitely experienced growing up, because I grew up in a very large family, people who, certain things that were bad that happened or that were dangerous that happened, and certain family members would overlook it and almost deny it, and others would see it. And so I learned from a young age, to follow your intuition.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
And there are things that you have to do to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have them, other things happen. Yeah.
Just one other thing that I wanted to mention about this. I didn't want to go too far, but the narration on this is beautiful. And I'm curious, as an actress, where you, when you're doing lines and then to have to do a narration like this, it sounds, it's a very different type of acting, is it not?
Yeah, it's definitely different. You know, it was the first time I ever did narration. I mean, this story was an experiment. You know, my agent had a hunch that it would be good. And so she kept pushing me to do it. And I did. And my husband's a musician and he has a studio. And he said, you know, why don't you record it? And you can use my sound engineer. And he has a very simple setup. It's a whisper room. Mm-hmm. Very small. You go in and he hooked up a mic. And actually, Adrian, who was the engineer, who's amazing, he only had one day to do it. Like available, because he was going to Switzerland. So basically I finished the story a few days before New Year's Eve last year at like 10 a.m. I was up early trying to finish it up. And I met him at noon and we spent 3 hours and I laid it all in one day. And I loved doing it. It was so much fun. And I thought, wow, I definitely want to do this again. It just, I felt like I was on the journey. I mean, it was really amazing. So something, and now I am starting to work, like tomorrow I'm doing an audio podcast and I'm starting to work in that field, which I never thought I would.
See,
I love the voices.
Yeah. Thanks.
Go figure, one opportunity changes everything to where you're going. And I want to go back to these demons. So what do you, if you relate demons to us in a everyday life, because again, looking at this, listening to it, and then coming back and our audience, your fans as well, understand the demons. What are signs of these demons that you talked about from childhood in this that we see today of ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that very specifically, like the way I wrote it, the children show up. And they asked to be invited in. So, you know, that's one thing that's very specific, like that, you know, you have to invite them in. And I think that, I mean, basically, I think the world, I think it's a metaphor for addiction and codependency. And not just drug addiction or alcoholism, but there's a lot of addiction out there. Mm-hmm. And that's why I call them the creatures of more. And in Plato's Odyssey, there are harpies and they feed, they need more. You can never satisfy them. And that's sort of what I was feeling. Like, I've had experience with addiction in my life and in people I love. But also this consumption that we have, you know, we can never, in some areas, we can never be satisfied. So that's what they were representing. And the woman of the house, Rebecca, she becomes entranced by them and she can't break the spell. So she actually gives up her whole family. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's far from the truth of our lives sometimes, that we'll overlook things over and over. And let's say it's not even as dramatic as a mother who's a drug addict who is separated from her children. But what about a mother or a father who's so overindulgent or engaged in whatever it is to such an extreme that they don't notice what's really going on anymore, and they don't notice what they're responsible for and who it affects, you know? But at the, you know, you got to the end, and I do think like the moral at the end, I mean, I like that kind of setup, that, because the truth is, look, we're human. We're going to make mistakes. Life is life, but we can always learn something and wake up one morning and start new. So, you know, you can make choices and draw lines easily if you notice them.
Where's the best place? Oh, so good. Dr. Tab, one more thing.
Very quickly. Storytelling is becoming more of an important art to all of us in business. When you're trying to get across what you do, how you do it, how you stand out amongst others, trying to write that story is an art. And that's one thing that I think everybody can learn something from is to keep doing it. Because as you do it, you do it better. And there's always a point to it.
Totally.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right. So where can people check you out? Best place to check out all your projects and stuff. Where is it?
My website, jenniferscaliascahan.com. My production company is 18bleakerfilms.com. And social media, Instagram or TikTok. I'm also doing 4 readings. I did one last weekend of The House in the Middle of the Street, and I'm doing another one this weekend on the 17th, and then the December 23rd. And then I'm going to finish it on New Year's Eve, because the story ends on New Year's Eve, and that's live on Instagram.
What times are those?
They December 17th, this Saturday, 10 PM Eastern time. And Friday the 23rd, 10 PM. And on New Year's Eve, 10 PM as well.
Very good.
Yeah. Well,
that should be fun.
Thank you for showing up and being interested in it. And, you know, the one last thing I'd like to say is that the story also touches on generational trauma. And that's really what the curse,
right,
is a metaphor for. And I think that, you know, the young girl that grows up in the story, at the end, because she's aware of what's happening, she can stop it. So I hope some people walk away and feel that and know that, and that maybe even get inspired in their own life to say, oh, no matter what's happened, like, if I see it, I can make choices for myself. So
there's so much going on around us. You have to critically think for yourself. It always comes down to, you got to keep number one in mind. So that's what you did.
Yeah. Thank you.
You know what, Jennifer, it's about, like, as you talked about doing this, how it opens up other opportunities, but doing also, what is your ultimate hope for your career in acting? Where do you want to see yourself?
Well, I will finish this story. There, it is a series. So we'll get to know why this happened and how it unfolds. But you know, I am going to direct next year a little story that I wrote, and I would like, you know, and that's an experiment. I'll see how that feels for me. But, you know, I'd love to just have roles that are meaningful to me and other people, and continue to write.
All right. We appreciate it, Jennifer.
Thanks.
Take care. All right. You're listening and watching The Neil Haley Show. We'll be back in just a moment.